Welcome to The Human Code, the podcast where technology meets humanity and the future is shaped by the leaders and innovators of today. I'm your host, Don Finley, inviting you on a journey through the fascinating world of tech, leadership, and personal growth. Here, we delve into the stories of visionary minds who are not only driving technological advancement, but also embodying the personal journeys and insights that inspire us all. Each episode, we explore the intersections where human ingenuity meets the cutting edge of technology, unpacking the experiences, challenges, and triumphs that define our era. So, whether you are a tech enthusiast, an inspiring entrepreneur, or simply curious about the human narratives behind the digital revolution, you're in the right place. Welcome to The Human Code. I'm here with Jim Schlexer, and I got to say, I'm really excited about today. Jim is an accomplished CEO. He is coaching CEOs on how to grow their business to the next level. Additionally, the man is a well-accomplished author, has two best-selling books. And as we were doing the pre-show, I got to say, we've got some interesting topics and a very passionate man about that intersection between humanity and technology. Jim, thank you for being on the show. And really, the first question that I have for you today is, how'd you get here?
Well, thanks for having me, Don. I appreciate it. Go way back when I was an engineer by undergraduate, but turns out I love business. I am a geek beyond words about business. And so I've studied it my whole life, hundreds and hundreds of books and personal experience and ran a bunch of different kinds of companies. And now I've taken all that accumulated knowledge and I help other people grow their businesses. And I love that because it tickles my two primary motivators. One is learning. I'm a huge learner, almost the definition. If you look up lifelong learner, my picture may well be in the dictionary. And then really my father modeled that for me. So I'm just following in his footsteps. And the other is impact. I really love to make a difference in people's lives. And that has been integrated into our purpose as an organization, which is to positively impact a million lives, which we do through our work. Yeah, just lots and lots of cycles. I was thinking about it. They talk about 10,000 hours to become an expert in something. I've got to be at 100,000. So whatever that is, I don't know, but I'm that.
10,000 hours of like purposeful practice is like a really amazing step to know what it can take to bring you to an expert level. When you're working with CEOs, where do you see that practice being done? Is it different for every CEO or are there a couple core competencies that they bring to the table?
We use a model of theory of constraints when we're working with people. And so the idea is that, and this is from a guy named Eli Goldratt, who was an Israeli physicist, wrote a book called The Goal. He applied it to a manufacturing operation, but any system you can name has a point of constraint that controls the capability of the whole system. The simple example is a garden hose. The garden hose has a kink in the hose, and that prevents water from getting out the end. So your job is to find the kink and open it up. Your business is a system. And somewhere in your business, there's a point of constraint, a kink that prevents it from achieving the revenue you want or the profit you want or serving the right number of clients or giving the right kind of experience or whatever you're after, there's a kink. And the job of the CEO is find the kink and open it up. So your point of like, where is the purposeful practice occurring? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on where that point of constraint is, because sometimes we have to go learn things to be able to open up the point of constraint. Sometimes we know. But if I had to pick, acquisition is probably the number one area where we have point of constraint. Nobody ever has enough revenue. Nobody ever has enough customers. And funny, somebody's a sales and marketing person from background, that may come more organically and naturally. CEOs don't always come from that place. Sometimes they're engineers or financiers or operations people. And in fact, I wrote an article just recently about how do you find a VP of sales? Because a lot of CEOs have no idea how to do it. They don't even know how to look at this person and understand if they're good or bad. So sales and marketing is a place where if I had to say, go spend lots of time on something, business model design and sales and marketing, those would be the two like way up my list.
I had, back in my corporate days, I had a boss who was a COO for the company that I was working for, but he was C-level at Black & Decker before, or the parent company of Black & Decker. And so this was a small organization. And I was sitting with him and he goes, the one thing that solves all problems is profit. And it's like, all you got to do is look at that and find out whether you have an income problem, you have a spend problem, right? But if you have an income problem, focus on sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. If you have a spend problem, focus on your engineering.
Point of constraint. He was just saying it a different way.
Yeah, exactly. And I love what you said here about finding the kink, open it up.
It's a simple job.
So why do we make it so hard then?
I actually blame MBA programs.
Okay.
Because they've got this concept of stakeholders, and they go, you run a business and you've got all these stakeholders who have an interest in your business, the community and the environment and political groups and government and your employees and your suppliers and your... And so these poor CEOs are running pillar to post trying to like satisfy constituencies in this way. And I'm not saying ignore them, but we've made it more complex than it needs to be, right? If I just said, look, your goal is to grow revenue and grow profit, just figure out what's getting in the way of that and go fix it. Now, you need discipline expertise to do that because it could be in HR, it could be in operations, it could be in marketing, it could be in finance, it could be anywhere. So you do have to be a generalist, but we get confused about the objectives sometimes, right? And when I say profit and revenue, yes, acknowledging shareholders, right? We can't screw the environment up. We can't be inappropriate to our employees. We should be good community stewards, all of that. But it's create profit in that environment versus satisfy those shareholders, and profit kind of comes second, or growth comes second, because growth and profit and growth and revenue is about taking care of your employees. I used to say, when I coach young people, I say, look, growth rate equals opportunity rate. If you're in a place that's growing, stuff's going to happen. You're going to get to do cool things. You're going to get to have neat experiences. You're going to learn stuff. You're going to, okay, what about a company that's going flat? What? Have to wait for somebody to leave? Got to wait for somebody to die? I don't know. It just is not nearly as exciting. I think we, if we're going to serve our people, need to keep growing so that they can keep growing.
I do love that. What you're saying here is we all have shareholders, or
yes,
really stakeholders, right?
Stakeholders.
You have the community, you have shareholders, you have every population of people, your employees.
Yep.
Business as its own entity as well is a stakeholder in the organization. But if you're focused on that key kind of like value creation of let's bring revenue and sales into the business and fulfill a need for our customer, that's success. And I feel like the conversation with your other stakeholders becomes a little bit easier.
Well,
when
but
you're
I think,
running a healthy organization. Like
I think
that.
You have to honor them. You have to honor their interests, but you can't give it primacy. You can't put it first. First is create value, service customers, grow the business to serve your employees. That's first. Acknowledging and respecting and honoring all the other people that have some level of interest in your business.
One other thing that you talked about was, and I'm struggling between actually holding this as an interview and then using it as a coaching session for my own business.
We can do a little of each.
Exactly. And I think this is beneficial because one, I'll be vulnerable. In regards to the business, I come from the engineering side. I come from a product side as well. And so systems, engineering, really core competency. And I can tell you that one of the things that I have failed as a leader in many iterations, and something that I am clearly still looking at as well, is building consistent sales organizations.
Yep.
And so you brought up that finding that VP of sales can be challenging. What have you seen as far as the people who are not able to fill that role or any role in their organization, and what kind of, I want to say, blocks that they have or experiences that they have in fulfilling that?
Yeah, I think on the sales and marketing side, the question is sales and marketing an art or a science? And the answer, I think, in good quality organizations is it's mostly science and a little bit of art. Like engineering, mostly science, a little bit of art. And I think you get people that think it's mostly art. So it's magic. We do stuff and we talk to people and we move them into Ray, we get a sale. This is the engineer in me. So this is appeal. Sales is a process. Sales can be measured. Sales has steps. There's a methodology we can track. There's an optimal methodology. We can test into better methodologies. This is why I love digital marketing so much, because it is the ultimate quantitative way of going to market. You can figure out what works, when it works, what my payback was, who responded, why'd they respond. I love it. So you take the approach that, and there's a book called The Ultimate Sales Machine. The fellow wrote it his past, but the whole idea is let's build a machine that delivers revenue consistently. That's a cool company. It's not easy to do, but that's a cool company. acknowledging there's a percentage of art and maneuvering, and I got that, but operate within a structure and a system, you're going to get a better result. And I think the big thing, and this is as companies mature, early days, we are talent dependent, meaning we've got to hire really good people and they're going to fill the holes and figure it out. And they're super smart and they've got all the motivation. As you scale, you're going to hire normal human beings because the average capability of your people is. And so if you're counting on superhumans, like my strategy is to hire superhumans, right? People with capes and red underwear and the whole deal. It's a bad strategy. So the only counter to that as we mature and we grow is to build processes that I can hire normal human beings and they can perform at a high level. And that's a sales system in the case of sales and marketing. So there's this yin and yang of talent and system as we grow and mature, start talent dominated and moving process dominated. And I think the trick for entrepreneurs is like, we don't want to over process our organization because we don't want to become bureaucratic. So there's like the lightest appropriate touch of process to get us where we got to get.
I love that you brought up the yin and yang, because that's the model that I was flowing this into, is there's the frame and then there's the chaos. And you need some of the chaos to stir up what can actually works, but you need the frame to hold that and to actually walk it through space. So yeah, that energy balance is something that I think we as entrepreneurs dance with.
Always. You know, I wrote an article about retention in software as a service businesses. It was published not that long ago. And what I spent a bunch of time on was the importance of relationship in retention, right? So the engineers would say, just build a better product. It's so incredibly great. Of course, they're going to renew. It's amazing, right? Why wouldn't they? Probably heard those words. I have, right? And it turns out that there's all these other things that go into the quality of the relationship that cause people to renew, which is all this soft and squishy stuff, right? About adaptability, flexibility, listening. So yeah, give me a framework, but then all the human factors may be actually the little secret sauce to get you over into the end zone.
Are you familiar with the lean startup methodology?
Yeah, I've read the book.
Okay, because it tries to take the aspects of the engineering life cycle of product development and engineering and then bring that into the rest of the organization. But I feel like you're staying, let's step a little bit farther outside of that. Let's give a little bit more freedom to understanding and diagnosing where that is, even though you may have a holistic look.
People buy from people. People work with people. People stay because of people. You can try to process the heck out of it, but there's a limit. It's ineffective at some point. But yes, yes.
I love that you, okay, so we're touching on SaaS. We've touched on some technology. Going to bring this over to what's going on with AI today.
Yep.
We're seeing a tremendous benefit from utilizing AI in our processes, and we're looking at it more as like an augmentation to human intelligence.
Yep.
And the customers that we're focused on are really the ones that have strong customer relationships, so that we could end up utilizing AI to take the things off their plate that aren't really that relationship based. So what you talked about as far as a sales for like people buy from people, right? Let's maintain that environment. Where do you see the interaction of humans and technology like playing along? Because there is that general fear that we're eliminating jobs, but we're also creating jobs at the same time. Where's the personal take that Jim has on this?
So I think about, and I talked to a lot of CEOs about this because they're really worried about how does AI play? What does it mean? Do I need to include it, adopt it? How should I strategize? I think about use cases. So where are the use cases where AI really makes sense? We're not going to throw it at everything. We're going to throw it at particular use cases where it does a better job or it augments the human involvement in a way. So examples, writing blog posts, right? I've used it for this. You give it an appropriate prompt, you get about 85, 90% of the way there, and then it has to be edited to be appropriate.
Yes.
Great utilization of my time. But to write the prompt and write it well to get the output I want actually does take human intelligence, because the machine is only going to do what you tell it to do. And then the editing on the back, because now eventually they'll get fully fluent, but sometimes AI generated stuff feels a little stilted in the way it's written. And then there's always the risk of hallucination, right? I just finished a program and I said, all right, write me one of a doctoral dissertation on this topic, blah, 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 APA 7 with citations. I was just fooling with it to see what it would do because I'd already written chapter one. It did a simple but passable job, right? But here's what happened. And I had read everything in this particular space. There were two citations that it mentioned. Man,
these are amazing citations. Oh, this is a great paper. How could I have missed this paper? So I went to go find the paper. Doesn't exist. Made it up. Because AI says it's relational. It says this author and this author should have written a paper on this topic, but they didn't. So it made it up. It hallucinated it. And so you have to be careful with oversight that you don't have hallucinations in your answers. The other place that we've seen people really being affected with AI is simple tasks, simple contracts, stuff like that, but also recommending engines.
Yeah.
So historically, recommender engines have been rule-based and hierarchical tree-based recommender engines. Do you want it this size or that size? Do you want it blue or yellow? Are you going to use it more than 10,000 miles or less than 10,000 miles? And that channels you into a product recommendation. And now AI can do that much more fluidly. And it's actually the case it's being used. It's not on that. It's on something else. It's on modification of marketing campaigns based on data. So analyzing the data, analyzing what's going on, and then recommending changes to improve performance based on everything it learns. The issue there is the size of the training set, right? So unless you have 10, 20, 30, 40,000 data points that you can feed into the system, you're not going to have enough training data to actually get useful data on the other side. So it's also only appropriate where there are large data sets that you can train the AI on.
We're looking at recommendation engines.
Yep.
Specifically, right? Like you're talking, the example you gave is like a rules-based system.
Yep.
So expert systems, which is still under the AI umbrella.
I know, but they're old. They've been around for 30, 40 years.
Oh, at least.
Yeah.
Actually, almost probably 80.
Yeah.
I like my undergrad degree is computer science with focus on AI.
Got it.
And so like I was educated during the time of an AI winter. And so we were learning, A, we learned about expert systems. B, we also learned about neural networks, which we couldn't even identify like handwritten characters at the time, but the theory was there and the principle behind it was there. That math was figured out in the late 60s. Hey, this is actually how neurons work. And so we could model this behavior. We went to recommendation engines that actually looked at you as a consumer and said, we'll use Netflix as an example, where you watch these shows and or you and I both watch shows A, B, C, and D. I watch show E, but you haven't seen it. So it will recommend to you show E because we look very similar. So that's similarity matching around that. But that requires millions of records and an extensive piece of data there. It's how Amazon's product recommendation system works, right? Like you try to find similarities in who these people are.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a ton of data. So even having 10,000, 20,000, tens of thousands of records for an LLM to process is a step in the direction of making this a little bit more accessible to more businesses.
Yep.
Yet at the same time, I agree with you. You need to have a quality set of training in order to actually make the product work.
Yep. Yep. We've also seen people using in recruiting. Analyzing video, analyzing resumes, trying to come up with a short list of people we should talk to. You do have to watch out for bias, and it relates to the training set, right? If it's a poor training set, you can induce bias into the engine. So you have to be just a squeak careful that you're not doing that. But all these are great use cases, and I think they're going to proliferate. I think we're in a bit of the frenzy of let's try it on everything right now. And what we're going to figure out is, okay, 50% of that was a bad idea, but 50% are really good ideas, and let's progress those.
Yeah. What do you see as being like a high quality use case? What defines that?
Good, high quality output, reliable, high quality output that needs to be oversighted still, but I can do that all day long regularly. That would be, there's limited variability in the outcome. I can get a good basic result first time out with a good prompt, of course. And then with some human oversight, you're done. So in other words, take the articles that I've written on it, 700-800 word blog posts, wrote a prompt, took me, I don't know what, 3 minutes or not even 2 minutes maybe to write a decent prompt. And then I spent 5 minutes editing it, right? Using Grammarly, by the way. It's another AI tool. So I'm 7 minutes in on an 800 word article. I couldn't have written that thing in 7 minutes. It would have taken me 25 or 30 minutes to write it properly. So I've saved 20 minutes, boom, and I can do that all day long. Pick your topic.
See, and I think that's a great use case where we're doing a similar type process as well, where I'll do these interviews, I'll take podcasts that I'm on, and we'll repurpose it into blog posts using the AI to read the transcript, come up with topics, and then assist in the writing of them, because you still need that human kind of like space. What do you see this changing our human interaction?
See, I actually think that it's going to make us more human.
Yeah,
because we're going to do the things that only we can do. And that's the human interaction, the human relational, the sensing of emotion, the empathetic stuff that we do. Maybe someday I will get there, but it's going to be a little bit before it figures all that out. I think it makes us more human. We end up losing sort of data crunching, manipulation. Computers have always been better at that, but we didn't have a format like this to use it. So I think you've extended what computerization and data use has happened. You know, we're really on, think about when computers first came into the workplace, it changed the whole dynamic of what people spent time on. And we spent time on higher value tasks that only we could do.
Yeah.
And we're just doing that again. It's another tool, right? It's another tool that elevates what we work on. For example, in code, straight up code slingers are probably a little bit at risk, right? Because you can enter the proper prompt and perfect code comes out. Code quality assessment. AI is awesome at finding the period or the comma or the semicolon that you missed, right? And that is a horribly difficult process for a human, right? But architecting the system and figuring out what the system should do and how it should do it and what's the look, feel. And I think AI is going to struggle with that one for a while. I'm not going to say never, but for now at least. So that human piece, we will continue to own, I think, and the higher order thinking, at least for a while, we're going to continue to own that.
It comes down to this is the first set of tools that we've actually created that has decision-making capability, right? Like the garden shovel doesn't figure out where it wants to actually move. We're seeing reasoning be an emergent quality of some of these systems that, while it's, let's say, in its infancy, we can extrapolate out where that could go. Mm-hmm. We don't know how fast it's going to go there. It feels like it's moving along at a breakneck speed right now, and we don't know where that will end and if the current technology that we have will get us there or we'll need another breakthrough.
But by the way, we're starting to run out of juice on the training sets.
Yeah.
In other words, they consume the entire internet and there's not enough. Now what do you to train it properly for some things? So now what do? That's all the data there is. Like, now what do we do?
Which is also amazing because you look at, bring this back to the human experience, right? And I was having this conversation with my brother yesterday. He has young children and we were talking about like the right time to introduce them to things in their life and when that happens. And when you're the age from 0 to 7 years old, your subconscious is literally like right in line with your conscious. Your conscious is just like sitting back and watching the show and going, everything that I'm taking in, I'm just going to embed into the operating system of that. And 95% of the things we do on a daily basis as adults are really automatic. There's somewhat automatic responses, and it takes a trained person you train yourself to recognize what patterns you want to break. And so forming of those patterns early, but bringing this back to the technology is you need a lot of data to make an LLM. You need a ton of data and a ton of repetition to do neural networks because of the way the math works. Yet the human brain can literally see something once, twice, three times and go, yeah, I'm going to rewire for that. So we require a lot less data to find the pattern that we want to like embed. Whereas an AI requires so much more data, and even my dog requires so much less data than an AI does today. So I imagine we're going to find some efficiencies in that. There's also been work on creating synthetic data, which is somewhat kind of an interesting topic as far as how that goes. But we could end up seeing models that require less data. In order to push
I think we have to, because think about the amount of processing power and the amount of just electrical power required to accomplish the it is the definition of brute forcing the answer. Just throw massive racks of NVIDIA GPUs at it and just crunch the, you got to break through. I was talking to somebody the other day, they were talking about how Amazon is becoming interested in nuclear power. Because they've been putting their data centers next to hydro for a while because they're like, we need so much. We're going to just stick it next to the power plant. And now they're like,
that's not big enough. We need a bigger power plant. Right? You'd be like, yeah. Or we could figure out, to your point, a more power and processor efficient model to get the answer without just brute forcing the heck out of it. So what's the 10x, 100x improvement in processing efficiency? And that may be your next breakthrough, right? Where I can deal with a smaller data set, use less energy, use less power, use less GPUs while I'm trying to get these answers out.
And I think we may actually see this as well, because one of the constraints on the growth of AI is actually the chipsets.
Yeah.
And it's not even the redesigning, or it's the manufacturing, it's getting the raw materials in order to make sure that we can create this, plus the power, plus water, right? Everything that goes into this, these are just massive beasts.
But yet we're just scratching the surface on AI, and we're already running into serious physical limits against it. That tells you something.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a beautiful time to experience this. Where, I guess, one of the questions that I have for you is, when we look at this bringing back more of the human-centric nature of this, how do you see this changing businesses from like both the CEO's role, as well as what the size of organizations are going to be, how they partner with other organizations? Do you see any bit of that changing as we incorporate more intelligent systems into it?
But we think of it as human augmentation. People will be able to get more done with the same number of humans, we get more done. And therefore, you'll see the revenue per person, the profit per person will grow over time, with some of that being reinvested in AI. So yes, I see for the same revenue company, less people in it. It's inevitable. Otherwise, the tool isn't working. If that doesn't happen, the tool isn't working, we shouldn't be using it.
So yeah, we've seen that trend over the last 40, 60 years anyways, and especially cloud computing.
Yep.
I know the example that I give is, if for me to create a $10 million company back in the 90s, I probably would have needed like 50 people.
Yep. Minimum.
Exactly. To do it in the early 2000s, Google was reporting revenue of about $1 million per person or employee. They had about one contractor for every employee. So you could cut that number in half. But still, we're talking like that's exponential as far as the improvement. And now we're going to see it that we might be getting to a company of one that is able to generate $100 million in revenue.
Yep. But the boundaries of what the company is and isn't changed a while ago, though, right? It's talked about it, 20 plus years ago, about people coming together virtually to create something, and they're them and they're not part of your company, but they do their thing as part of this effort we've got. And then at the end of the effort, they may leave and go do something different. So what's the company at that point? Well, I don't know. It's, I guess, the guy or gal in the middle of it. Yeah. Work will be done by amorphous, mobile, ever-changing groups of people. Some of them will be in the sticky core potentially, but everything around the outside is going to move and change over time. Virtually, they're going to live in wherever they want to live, Boston, DC, whatever turns you on. So work is locationless, and affiliation to a company is going to change as well. Now, that may be a bit, you got to wait for some of the older people to die off that got this old model of punching the clock and showing up at 8 o'clock. But the reality is, so much of the work we're doing is brain work, not physical work. Location is irrelevant, and affiliation to a company is irrelevant. And I think what may be limiting is people's mental model of, it's important to be part of a company. It's safer to be part of a company. Which is actually an illusion. You probably know this as well as I do. It's an illusion to be part of a company. Tesla just laid off 10% of their workforce.
Yeah.
A week ago, they all felt great to have a Tesla badge, and now they're looking for work, right? Or would you be better to be in control of your own ship, and I do great work, and I got 30 people who love the work I do, and they'll hire me whenever they need that kind of work? That's probably a safer position to be in. So, but people still have that mental model, I think, that they've got to get around. But yes, higher leverage with the use of the tool, a little more virtual in terms of what a company is and what's the definition of a company. And that's got all kinds of implications, like, for example, taxation. They talk about, it's a U.S. company. Really? What is a U.S. company? I got 30 people in Philippines and 10 people in India and 20 people in Germany and 2 in the U.S. Is that a U.S. company? I don't know. I mean, governments are going to struggle with this too.
And I think you can already see it, because there are some companies that are trying to recruit the digital worker as well. Estonia has an e-passport, I believe it is, or something for the digital nomad.
Yep.
As well. And then additionally, like, I'm trying to think of what jurisdictions we were looking at for one of our other companies, but it blanking on me right now. That is absolutely fascinating too. How do you see this impacting your personal life?
I'm trying to intelligently embrace it, right? I'm generally not a first adopter. I'm a sort of second or third tier adopter. And so I'm looking for those really good use cases, and then I'll adopt them into my own little eco, if you will. I've already adopted the blog post writing. That's obviously an easy one. There will be others as they mature and develop. I'll let other people take the bumps and bruises, and then I'll bring them into my own life. Like,
I'm here for you.
Thank you. Calendar management, organizing travel would be clear, analyzing conversations with clients, for example, and potentially even, I'll just give an example, like we do a fair amount of working with CEOs and bringing them on as clients. So there's a sales process. It would be fascinating to have that transcripted and then analyzed by AI to coach you on how to improve your process, if possible.
We're doing, and this is something we could talk about offline, or actually we can even talk about it here. We're doing discovery calls with clients.
Mm-hmm.
We take the transcript of that, feed it into an AI to help us write the proposal.
Love it.
And so it took a 20-hour process and brought it down to 3 to 5 hours for us.
Man, that's great.
Yeah. So like constantly seeing ways, but you still need the human in the loop and you still need that qualification. It's not a replacement for us. It's augmenting
always what
we're doing, right? Like we treat it like a really amazing intern.
And go one further, right? They have this in call centers. They have voice analytics to determine emotional state based on the voice.
Yeah.
We're doing the pitch and we're listening to the voice, and the voice analytics are telling if they're receiving it and responding the way we would hope they would. And now you've got a feedback loop on, did they like what we said? Did they resonate to it? Did they engage in it? And the next one gets better, and the next one gets better, and the next one gets better. So those, I think those would be some really interesting use cases.
Okay. So we save all this time for you.
Yeah.
I imagine some of this time is going to end up going towards serving more people. Because you do have the goal of serving a million plus people.
Fantastic. Impacting a million lives, yes.
Impacting a million lives. Thank you. What lights you up in your personal life?
Maybe three things. I tell my friends, so much to do in so little time, right? So there's an infinite number of things to do, but monstrous soccer player. So more soccer, if that's possible. I do love wine and studying wine and drinking wine with friends. That's always way fun. And I like to do some adventure travel. I'm a big traveler. In fact, I'm literally leaving for Peru to hike the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu shortly after this. But yeah.
Okay. So we do have some similarities. I know you also, both of us have climbed Kilimanjaro.
Yes, we have. Same route, which is shocking.
Exactly. I haven't done the Inca Trail, but my story, and I've told this on the show before, I was in Africa climbing Kilimanjaro, and you know how you climb overnight and then you turn around, you watch the sunrise. Glorious. Or maybe I should ask you, how'd you feel about it?
We didn't do the get up at 4 a.m. and climb up, but what we did have one night was an eclipse at 15,000 feet. So,
oh my God, that's gorgeous.
It was, and the giant moon. Oh my God, it was like... insanely, amazingly lucky to be there at that particular time. It was great. It was great.
So we started, we did the midnight climb at 6 a.m. is when you reach the caldera. Mm-hmm. And so you turn around and you wait for the sun to rise. And it was just maybe 15 minutes or something, but you're panting, trying to catch your breath.
Yep.
Realizing that the air looks the same because air doesn't look like anything. It's not there. Or you know the oxygen isn't.
Yep.
And all my friends have this smile on their face. They're just loving it. Like they're really appreciating the moment. And I couldn't get out of my own head to enjoy it. Ugh. And it was in that moment, like business was growing, checking all the boxes. Life was great, right? Like everything that could be written down on paper was hitting it. And I was miserable. And I noticed in that moment, I was like, it's me.
Yeah.
I'm the one that's creating this. So I ended up in Peru a month later. Because of some friends that I met, and I was like, you guys do business in a way that I want to be doing business. And so show me what you're up to. And they're like, you can join us in Peru. And so I went there, was at Machu Picchu for a few days, the Sacred Valley, and also Cusco.
Yep.
As well. That is amazing. So you have your trip to Peru, doing the Inca Trail. Sounds absolutely fantastic.
I can't wait. I love being outside. And relative to the works,
you're out of communication. So somebody was asking me, like, what happens if there's an emergency? I'm like, somebody's going to have to figure it out, but it won't be me. And that's a little freeing to be able to say that to yourself.
I do that as well sometimes. Like, I'll go away from the business for a couple weeks and hope that something breaks so that the team can step up.
Yep.
And then additionally notice if they were able to handle it, fantastic. And if they weren't able to handle it, then we know that's another kink in the hose to like relieve. So I'm glad to hear that somebody else who I admire in this space has taken the effort to do similar processes.
Just a quick story on that. Used to be when communication technology wasn't quite as good, I would travel. I'd be going to see clients or whatever. So I designate somebody to be in charge. We called them the DJ, the designated Jim, right? We'd send the email, hey, I'm going to be traveling next week. Phil's the DJ this week. And usually I'd coach him. I go, look, just don't burn down the building. Okay. That's all I'm asking, right?
Yeah.
So there's one time I called in like midweek. Bob happened to be the DJ that week. I'm like, hey, Bob, how's it going? He goes, you know how you said don't burn down the building? I'm like, oh, no. He goes, it was a small fire and we put it out. So yeah, they figured it out. But honest to God, the behavior, what was really cool for me is when they hit something hard, they huddled up and they said, all right, let's talk this out. Let's figure it out. And they would almost always come up with the right answer or close enough to the right answer that I didn't care. It was great. It was a massive team development effort, ultimately.
And that is like one of the best things to see is like when the team comes together, embodies the values that the business has, that you have, that you've instilled into the organization, and you see them acting upon that without you having to be there is like one of the joyous moments. I don't have children, but like I compare building businesses to like fostering growth in a conscious entity. And like when you can see that take root and sprout and grow, it's fantastic. Any words of wisdom that you have to people who are starting their career coming up, or even our CEOs who are new to this role?
Different advice for people coming up. There is no replacement for just doing the work. There is no replacement. There is not an easy path. I hate to feel sound like your dad, but this is what my dad told me, right? But you just got to do the work. There is no, we talked to her before off air about getting 10,000 hours of cycles. And that is funny enough, they talk to billionaires and the smart ones sometimes will say, follow your passion. But the smart ones will say this, they go, forget passion. Find something you like enough to spend 10,000 hours at it, getting really good at it. The passion will follow because you're really good at it, because you've spent the time, you've done the work to get good at it. So that's the young people. Figure out what you want to spend 10,000 hours getting great at, and passion will follow. You can't do something you hate. Don't get me wrong. You got to like it enough to spend the time. And then for CEOs, I think the big one for me is it is a very isolating and lonely job. You don't have peers. You don't have people you can talk to. And so we build these CEO peer groups, whether you use us or somebody else, or build your own mastermind group, but having a infrastructure around yourself to ask questions and just bang things against and check your thinking, and it can't be replaced. And that's not your board. It's somebody without an agenda who listens to you, is super smart, who will give you feedback, and preferably a couple people's, not just one. So early in the CEO job, build that infrastructure around you early, and it will serve you going forward.
I love that. Jim, thank you so much for being on. If our audience is interested in reaching you, is there anywhere they can find you?
Yeah, you can go to theceoproject.com or jim@theceoproject.com and we'll get right back to you. And we're on TikTok and Instagram and LinkedIn and every other social media platform on the planet, but that'd be the easiest way.
I love it, man. Thank you so much for being on with us today.
It's a great pleasure, Don. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning into The Human Code, sponsored by Findustries, where we harness AI to elevate your business. By improving operational efficiency and accelerating growth, we turn opportunities into reality. Let Findustries be your guide to AI mastery, making success inevitable. Explore how at findustries.co.